Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Well, good day to you. This is Andrew Horowitz, and welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is episode number 131. We are now towards the middle end of October. Say goodbye to Columbus Day, and hello to earnings season. That's what's been going on lately. It's been very interesting earnings season. We're seeing a continuation of what we saw before, but a lot of companies are doing quite a bit better at least managing their expenses. Alcoa came out. We saw that. Interesting numbers. Stock went up about 7% that day, came down a bit. As a matter of fact, came down to exactly where it was on the day of the release. So not much of a pop there. And then we saw some other numbers. We saw the banking industry come out. Meredith Whitney came out with a surprise downgrade of Goldman Sachs, if you recall that. That was earlier in the week. And lo and behold, Goldman came out, had good numbers, but wasn't the same blowout as last quarter. Stock was down about 2%, no big deal. We saw also Citibank get kind of smashed, I think down 6% on the day of their earnings that came out. And Capital One also in sympathy because of the credit card issues. Concern about the continuing write-downs and set-asides that we had from J.P. Morgan as well. So big week for that. We also IBM come out with numbers. Now, what was interesting about IBM was that their numbers looked actually good, looked very good as a matter of fact. Their projections looked even better. And the stock was down in after hours. Now, we'll see, how that plays out, through the next few weeks. But, generally speaking, that throughout the earnings, there was an expectation running up into the earnings for IBM, and then kind of just petered out that day and right afterwards. But we also saw Google come out with earnings, and they actually saw an increase. Stock popped on that earnings release. So lots happening right now, and some interesting numbers, plenty of other things that happened also. We saw the jobless numbers, or I should say the initial claims, come out on Thursday. And if I recall, that was about 520. Still over the 500,000 initial claims mark. That means people are still being let go, which means essentially that employers are still looking to cut costs because demand is down. That is not a healing economy as of yet, but there is a separation of the economy clearly with the markets because you can bring down expenses and the bottom line is better. Bottom line is all we're talking about when it comes to equities, obviously. We also saw some interesting things. Singapore raised their guidance in terms of the country. it sounds like a company, but they raised their guidance and they raised their projections of what's going to happen in the future. We like Singapore and Korea. I think that's great. Brazil is just on fire. Crazy, just on fire. Oil, 77 plus range. There was a big drawdown this week. So everything's kind of coming up as if there is some real good things, or shouldn't say as if, but the reality is that things are looking a bit better. There are some definite holes out there. We found some areas that were a problem. We have some concern about the casino gaming industry. China put they're starting to talk about putting a restriction on the amount of machines, the amount of tables, as well as the age of gaming in Macau. And that's going to be a problem for Wynn and Las Vegas Sands. And the other thing that I want to mention to you is that if you remember last week, we went into in-depth discussion about a stock. We talked about Starint, symbol STAR. Now, right after that came out, we talked about that. Actually, I talked about that on DH Unplugged about 3 days before this podcast came out. And then talked about it again on this podcast and put out some information on the site. Starint was bought out since then, so if you didn't get it, you can't get it anymore. And we made about 45-50% on that. The buyout was by Cisco with about a 20-plus percent premium from the close on last Monday. And they were bought out, I believe, on Tuesday. I think it was Tuesday. Maybe it was Wednesday. I think it was Tuesday. And so that was good. That was a good play. Now what's happening, of course, some people are not happy that it's not, or they're not happy that it's not enough money. Haven't we heard this before? Same thing happened with the Perot family. that is now suing Dell and suing the board of directors. Now, it seems that Starint is also suing some shareholders suing Starint and Cisco for not getting good enough of a price. It should have been a much higher premium. So greed always seems to get in the way, but we know all about that. But today we do have a great guest on. We're going to bring him on in a second. We've had him on a couple of times in the past. Haven't talked to him on the podcast in a while. His name is Barry Ritholtz. Probably writes the number one economic and finance blog on the web. Name is The Big Picture, but Ritholtz.com. You've seen him. He has a book out. He has a great product out called Fusion IQ. And we're going to bring him on and talk with him because we always have a really good in-depth discussion. Great guy, good friend, and good friend of the show. Before we get to that, I want to talk about GoToMyPC. You know, one of the things that's interesting is that so many times you feel, I don't know, kind of locked down and change your office computer or, you know, you just can't get the information that you do at the office at home. Well, you know what you can do? You can break the chains and go to use GoToMyPC because you can access your office computer right from your house or anywhere, laptop, whatever it is. No more late nights or weekends coming to the office because you can use any program, work on any file, check your email, and access the network resources at your office right from your computer wherever you are because it's so easy to set up and use and secure. It's great. So the good news is, if you haven't done this, you really need to check this out, that our listeners can get a GoToMyPC free trial for 30 days, totally unlimited remote access for free. If you haven't checked that, it's a really cool process. If you haven't checked that, you should. Here's what you need to do. Just go to www.gotomypc.com/podcast, www.gotomypc.com/podcast. It's gotomypc.com/podcast, and you can get a free trial for 30 days, and I encourage you to do that. Cool, cool program and system. Before we get Barry on the phone, what I want to also mention to you is thank you for everybody who voted and nominated this show and the other shows that we do for the podcast, the annual podcast awards. We'll tell you when the voting is open. Keep your mind and your thoughts open on that. We'll make sure that we'll get you that information and vote many times or as many times you're allowed to for the show, The Disciplined Investor. I really appreciate it. And finally, we haven't mentioned in a couple weeks, I don't think, but if you're interested in us managing your money, of course, we have that access for that 14-minute virtual tour. Just go to the show notes at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And if you missed out on Starint last week, you would have found that we wrote about that previously, and that's been something that we've been tracking for a while. And a few other ones that we mentioned on the show was like Mercado Libre, and we also mentioned Asia, ASIA. Take a look at those stocks. You'll see what I'm talking about. But we also had the stock charts up last week, and if you would have gotten on that, you would have made a quick 20% overnight on that. That was pretty cool. Pretty happy about that. I hope we made money for you. If we did, let me know. Send me an email at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We're going to be right back with Barry Ritholtz talking about economy. You won't want to miss this. He is great. And I love talking to him. We get so many great comments when he's on. So stick around. We'll be right back on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And an old friend of the show, someone who hasn't been on for a while, his schedule is pretty crazy these days. You see him around on TV. He's talking his book, or about his book, not of his book. And a good friend of mine on the show, Barry Ritholtz, is here. He is the author of Bailout Nation. Of course, the one of the higher-ups in Fusion Analytics, a great software product that helps you make some great decisions when it comes to understanding individual stocks, et cetera. So, Barry, how are you?
Pretty good. How about yourself?
It's good. I've been good. It's been a while. We've talked, but it's been a while to have you on the podcast, and I know there's always a lot of people that want to hear you.
I've been on tour. It's been around the world book promotion slash nightmare, which I thought when you wrote a book, when you were finished writing, you were done. It turns out not so much.
You know, I wrote a book a couple years back, and actually, I haven't told anybody this yet, but there's another one coming very soon, and this one's going to be a big
media
thing.
You're a brave man.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to ask you. It's like giving birth, isn't it, if we were having to know what that's like?
No, I know exactly what it's like. It's I literally put on about 20 pounds writing the book. I wanted to say, which, by the way, mostly came off pretty quickly, so now I'm merely fat as opposed to very fat, but between the Caramel Macchiatas and just, you know, cranking down. It was a sad day when New York City started requiring the calorie counts at the various Starbucks.
Right.
So the banana bread that I like is like 450 calories. Oh. A bagel with cream cheese is less than that.
Right.
And the caramel macchiato is like 500 calories.
Right.
It was like, oh, so let's see. It's an afternoon snack, writing the book, 1,000 calories. Do that a couple of times a week
right.
for a year and a half,
right.
and no big deal.
Right. So now you just have what we call blogger belly. Right?
Say again?
Now you have what's just called blogger belly.
That's I'll take fat middle-aged white guys for 100.
Exactly. And a side note, by the way, you could look up a blogger's exercise routine. You write, you do 3 push-ups, you write a little bit more, you go do some pull-ups, then you write a little more and you do a little jog. There's a whole routine to make sure the bloggers stay in good health because, you know, the importance of the bloggers out there.
But, you know, I used to swim and run on a regular basis, and my wife just said, let's join the Y and start swimming again.
Yeah, so, that's nice. Swimming's good.
I'm going to be forced into it whether I want to do it or not.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about the economy, your specialty. There's something that I found interesting. Some of the names that we know so well, a Stiglitz, a Rubini, you know, the guys that quote-unquote, you know, this fascination, who called the bottom, who called the top, who called the recession, they came out very recently and became much more negative, I think. Well, they were quiet for a while, but they became much more negative on the economy, it seems, than potential for a double dip. And concern about what's going to happen in the next 6 months. Did you get that?
Yeah, very much so. First of all, I don't know how you can have a double dip. I am not convinced that the recession so much has ended. Certainly the Great Recession, the
right.
panic and the horror show that was September 08 to March 09 ended. And this looks and feels and the data supports that this is just your run-of-the-mill recession.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that... You know, when you come off the bottom, no longer being in free fall, you know, it's I don't know if you're a football fan, and it's the Detroit Lions. Hey, they're not going to be 0-15 this year.
Right, right.
You know, the fact they won a game, they'll probably still be in last place. But we're in that sort of recession
mm-hmm,
right now.
Mm-hmm.
That look, we're still losing 250,000-plus jobs following, 600,000, 800,000, 700,000 jobs. Retail sales are still terrible. If you back out the government prop, the cash for clunkers, you saw the data this week was pretty punk. Look at housing, but for 0% interest rates and first-time home buyers, cash credits, there ain't a whole lot of activity going on there. That's not seasonal. So by and large, I think the economy, it's not that we're in danger of a double dip. I don't really believe the recession ended.
Well, but we're talking about now, when a double dip, we're talking about what I find interesting is that coming off the bottom, the mathematical equation to go back to the GDP, which is the fascination again by everybody, thinking that if GDP goes positive and we're out of recession, we sort of walk out the door into happiness and golden times. You know, there's nothing different. It's like kind of when you turn 40, it's like, I don't feel any different. I'm just, now it's just, I say I'm 40. So it's like when you come out of the recession, that doesn't mean everything is all, you know, wonderful and all of a sudden, you know, you get your job back and, you know, all of a sudden everything goes back. Yeah, your raises are going up. But what's interesting is that the mathematical equation to get to a positive GDP from the bottom is much easier, especially
sure.
when everything is being done by the government to push things into
right.
what would cause the GDP to go up.
You know, you look at past recessions, they very often had positive GDP. They start from a positive GDP. I keep reading... before the recession was officially announced, all manner of idiots were saying, well, how can you have a recession? We have a positive GDP.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's peak to trough. So if you're plus 6%, the way you get to negative is you got to work your way through plus 3%, plus 1%.
Right.
So that's no surprise. Secondly, GDP, like so many of the official BLS data, you know, it's an odd amalgam of numbers. My favorite example with GDP is... imports subtract from GDP. If you think about it, we're spending money on stuff brought over here, but it's manufactured elsewhere, so therefore it subtracts from GDP. And what we've seen over the past few months is consumer sales have been plummeting, spending has been plummeting, but domestic purchases have been falling much more slowly, in large part due to the weak dollar, than overseas purchases. So... The fact that we're buying less BMWs and less Lexuses, but also buying less stuff in America, somehow adds up to a positive GDP number. The imports are falling faster than domestic purchases, and therefore that's a net positive. No, it's a terrible thing. You're spending less money. There's less economic activity, whether it's made in the U.S. or Canada or Europe or Japan. There's less, and yet somehow that adds up to a positive.
That makes sense.
So, and yet, you know, but yet the way the GDP data deals with imports is, you know, we have, by the way, the flip side of that is when oil prices were going up and we were spending more on imports, it was taking away from GDP, and that was pretty ass backwards also.
Right.
So when you look at the GDP data, it's really a very imperfect way to look at economic activity. What you want to look at are four things. You want to look at industrial output. What are we actually making? What are we actually producing? And that includes manufacturing as well as services. You want to look at consumer spending. Are people buying clothes and food and durable goods and houses and cars? You want to look at the employment data. Specifically, are we creating or losing jobs? And then within the employment data, you want to look at income. Are we paying people more or less money to go out and spend on these things? And there are a number of other things you can also add to the mix, but those are the big four, output, spending, employment, and income. And you take those four and you see, are things getting better or are things getting worse? Well, parts of them are still getting worse, but they're getting worse at a much more gentle rate. We're no longer in a free fall. The parachute is open, and some stuff is doing poor. I would say 250,000 jobs a month is a pretty lousy number. If you look at what happened in 2001, I think the peak was something like 260,000 jobs. And we're doing that on a regular basis, although after that recession ended, we had 6 months of, you know, 140, 160, 120, 80, 90, things like that. So after recession ends, we should expect another 6 months or so of bad numbers. Just these are really bad numbers. 250,000 plus is really bad. It's obvious that the consumer doesn't have access to credit, doesn't have a stockpile of cash, and they're spending much less, and that's going to be a significant factor. The one sort of, I don't want to say green shoot, but silver lining is that corporations seem to be pretty clean balance sheets, at least outside of the financial sector. They have a decent amount of cash and a limited amount of debt. So most of corporate America, ex-financials, which is a giant X, but are pretty deleveraged. And to me, the cure for the financial leverage is just going to be time and waiting this out. I still think the financial sector is a wreck. They're hiding their losses. They no longer have to mark to market. They love mark to market on the way up, where they could, you know, pretend to be making all this money and pay themselves big bonuses. As soon as the market reversed, they started screaming, oh, this mark-to-market is killing us. Well, great, give us back all your bonuses. Give us back all the money you took when you were loving mark-to-market,
right.
And we'll talk about getting rid of mark-to-market. It's not a coincidence that this rally began shortly after or around the same time as mark-to-market was suspended to allow us technically insolvent banks to continue operating.
Yeah, I mean, amazing. I mean, that was the kickoff. Was the Vikram Pandit letter, if I recall correctly, that was the start of the whole thing. So one of the things that's interesting is there's an article that should be, by the time everybody's listening to this, it should be posted. Something that we think that employment. I'm saying this kind of tongue in cheek, but high unemployment is actually good for corporate America. There's something that we looked at very carefully over the last, however, you know, many months. You know, we see EPS is meeting analysts. I'm starting to have more than no use for that I've usually had no use for.
Welcome to the club.
You know, and then you know, looking at revenues. But what's interesting is it's clear that the highest cost we know, or one of the besides you know, cost of goods, if you will, is the unemployment part, the benefits, the salaries. And they're cutting them and doing an unbelievable job at keeping profitability, or at least, you know, meeting their expectations. We call this, as I see it, consumption cannibalism. Alcoa, in their last conference call, came out and said that 75% of their overall staff and employee base is going to be gone. Even if demand comes back, they're considering those permanent firings. So therefore, I look at the robotics, and people have heard me say this before. I haven't talked to you about this, but people look at the robotics and the technology and all things. But I say, you know what? Robots and technology don't eat. They don't go to the bathroom.
They don't consume.
They don't consume. There's nothing. So it's great for a little while, but who's going to buy the products that this particular manufacturing firm is putting out if there's nobody has the money to do so? Am I off base?
The Chinese will buy the products.
That's all you have to do is say the Chinese. That's good.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. You raise a valid issue. First of all, you can only cut costs for so long.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the earnings gains have come not from top-line growth, but from bottom-line cost savings. And so you can only, you know, eventually you're down to the bone. That's number one. Number two, it does reflect a macro issue of if every company is laying off in order to meet their quarterly numbers, well, who's left to buy the goods and services? Eventually, we're going to create an enormous pile of people that, you know, are on a very constrained shopping budget. And maybe that's good for the Costcos and Walmarts of the world, but it's probably not great for the nation as a whole to have an underclass of either unemployed at 10% or underemployed at 20%. You know, it's a variation of the tragedy of the commons. And there is no company that's going to say, well, I'm not going to fire these people so they can continue working and buying products. It benefits me as a company to cut staff or to outsource it to China or India in order to meet my numbers. And, you know, there's a lot to be said about the obsessive focus on quarterly numbers as opposed to long-term growth, but that's really a whole different argument. So this consumer cannibalism, as you described it, it's a short-term fix. I would like to see some job creation elsewhere. It's a huge benefit to everybody in the country, both corporate and individuals, if you're not running excessively high unemployment numbers. That's not a good thing for pretty much anybody except the companies who made their quarter.
Right.
Until the natives get restless and storm the castle, and then you have a whole different set of problems.
Let's finish up with this. The current deficit, the health care bills or initiative or whatever you want to call it, supposedly a non-cost item, which obviously that means it costs something. And you know, how where do you stand on this whole thing in terms of not really politically or whatever, but you know, does this make sense that we're going to have a government-sponsored / legislated healthcare plan that already is up to $900 billion, but somehow is going to save all sorts of money?
Well, mathematically, there are a couple of things in there that actually are cost savings. First, right now, you're paying for that health care service for people who are uninsured anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But instead of going to the doctor so their kid gets a $45 flu shot, they wait until it's a disaster and they go to the emergency room where they can't be turned away legally.
Right.
And you end up with a much more costly procedure just because it's in an emergency room. And so now it's $2,000 worth of medical services instead of $45. And when you're unable to pay for it, guess what happens? You and I are paying for that anyway. The insurance company pays for it in higher premiums across the board. The public pays for it in higher costs. That consumption of unpaid healthcare goods doesn't disappear. It's out there. We're just paying for it in a extremely inefficient, extremely costly way. That's one way to approach. The second thing, and I don't know if the current administration or Congress has the testicular fortitude to stand up to the pharmaceutical lobby. I doubt it. But one of the things that Medicaid has always done well is really reduce costs and put different companies competing with each other. And the big giveaway in the Bush prescription drug plan was it prevented negotiations on bulk purchases of prescriptions. Now, you know, people get all bent out of shape about Viagra for people who have prostate issues, and why are we all paying for some old man's erection aid medicine if he's on Medicaid? But to me, that's a tiny marginal issue. The bigger issue is this is a multi-trillion-dollar drug plan. Why the hell aren't we negotiating for the best price as taxpayers? And just shows you how bought and paid for the whole Congress is. The entire system is so corrupted. But so that's another cost savings. There's a bunch of other things. Well, for example, if you just standardize the forms, the healthcare forms, instead of every insurance company requiring a different form, it's an absurd amount of money that's wasted. And then stop and think about how much of the middleman between you and your doctor, how much of the insurance company, and I say this as someone who's with good insurance has basically gone through an ordeal with insurance companies, and I think a good start would be to slowly send most of the healthcare insurance executives to Guantanamo, where we can attach electrodes to their genitals. But but essentially, if you can stop all the effort that goes into not ferreting out fraud and waste, but just preventing people with legitimate injuries and issues from getting medical care, because it's easier to, apparently cheaper to spend money preventing people doing that than actually paying for the medical care. Once you stop that for profit, I forgot what the technical term is, the A, dropping people with legitimate insurance, and B, just doing what you can to prevent them from getting health care. There's just so much waste in our system. We spend so much more than everybody else that I just can't and don't necessarily get much for it. Healthcare isn't my issue. I haven't read any or all of the proposals out there, so I'm not going to opine on them specifically because I really don't have a lot to say. But I can tell you, as someone who spends his life looking at numbers and systems and broad macro issues, our system is completely and totally fucked, and there has to be something that's better than it.
Yeah.
It's hard to imagine.
You were a practicing lawyer, right?
Maybe not. I haven't practiced for years, but I...
But what about tort reform? What about tort reform? I mean, don't we have to have somewhere in there?
Tort reform is a relatively small number out there. I mean, I never did plaintiff work.
Right.
But I think the CBO number for 10 years was something like $50 billion. So in the scheme of a multi-trillion dollar industry, $50 billion over 10 or $54 billion, whatever it is, over 10 years. But as long as we're talking about tort reform, put that on the table.
Right.
And then put on the table the sort of, blue line of silence that the medical profession has. There are so many accidental deaths in hospitals. And I'm not just talking the viral infections, which should be more stoppable, but just... There are far too many doctors that just shouldn't be doctors. Just, and I'll tell you, the same is true for lawyers and brokers and traders and, you name it. But the medical profession seems to do a bigger job of protecting and closing on their own ranks. I'll never forget the article in the Times, this has got to be like 20 years ago, about the doctor that essentially left the scissor in the purse. The person was having a stabbing pain every time they bent over. Oh, goddamn scissor left inside them, and it was only like 10 years later the person gets an x-ray and they found the scissor. And stop and think about, look, nobody is perfect. Nobody can expect every case to have a perfect outcome. You just want to make sure at least that the process is fair and intelligent and not fraught with mistakes. But every state has their own medical board, and they, for the most part, do not do an aggressive enough job ferreting out bad doctors. And I'll say the same thing is true for lawyers. I know far too many lawyers that really shouldn't be practicing.
Yeah, well, it happens
the
in every industry.
The difference is lawyers don't kill you when they make a mistake.
Right.
You just end up in jail.
Well, where
you're eventually stabbed with a shiv and die. So it's a once removed.
Right.
But there's so many different things we could do to fix the healthcare system.
Well, isn't it the SROs, the self-regulatory organizations, like what we had in finance? Basically, we had the wolves watching over the wolves.
Yeah, it doesn't work. It's pretty clear that bankers can't regulate bankers,
right.
Wall Streeters can't regulate themselves. And I'm going to tell you, so far, I think doctors have done a pretty crappy job regulating themselves. And the same is true for lawyers. The problem is that you need an honest broker to step forward and have a degree of expertise. And you end up getting that expertise from people within the industry. It's very difficult to get a doctor to say, hey, you went to 4 years of college and however many years of medical school and residency and internship, and we're not impressed with you. You're out of a job.
Right.
It's tough to get a doctor. Just like it's difficult to get a board of lawyers to say, 3 years of law school and you pass the bar and you've been practicing for a couple of years, but we think you suck. Go try a new profession.
Right, exactly.
It's a tough thing to do, and unfortunately, it needs to be done more often.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, Barry Ritholtz, I thank you for joining me today. Listen, everybody, if you haven't had the opportunity to check out Barry's book, Bailout Nation. By the way, I want to say something. You had that name, and then Kudlow started using it for his little commentaries every once in a while. Are you allowed?
I think he's just promoting the book.
Oh, is that how you look at it? Okay, that's how you look at it. I just want to make sure we're clear about that, because every time it kind of it made me wince.
The book was actually named by Bill Fleckenstein.
Oh, really?
Who did the foreword to the book.
Yeah.
He's the guy who came up with the name, and obviously a variant for you younger listeners on Prozac Nation, a famous book from, God, what is that, 30 or 40
that's
years
old.
Ago?
That's old. Yeah, yeah.
Before my time, yeah. More or less.
But, Bill's great. Bill's great. He talk about a guy who shut down his short-only fund at the right time.
Unbelievable,
unbelievable.
Right?
I mean, he was on the show. He was on the show that week that he was doing it.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating that, look, it's. I wonder if he, as we get close to 11 or 12,000, if he's going to turn around and reopen it.
Right.
The fascinating thing to look at when you look at the market here, because everyone keeps asking, and I thought you were going to go there when we were talking about the economy, is how much of the market is forecasting an improvement in the economy? And my answer is, what does one thing have to do with another?
Right.
You know, it's everyone forgets, over the last decade of Japan, the Nikkei had four separate rallies of 50% or greater,
mm-hmm.
and the economy never recovered. The fact that we're up 60% is telling me that we're unwinding the end of the world trade because the world didn't end.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that the economy is off to the running. Always beware of economists who look to the stock market to tell them what the economy is going
to
do.
It's sometimes a good way to understand what's happening, though, in terms of especially on the way down.
Well, you know, but at what point do you say the market is no longer forecasting what's taking or discounting what's
right.
taking place?
Well, that's what bothered
in the future,
me.
And it's just a mass. You know, what was the S&P? What was the Dow saying at 6,500? It was saying the world is coming, the financial world was coming to an end.
Right.
Just like, go back to 2000, you know, when the NASDAQ was at 5,100, the only conclusion was profits don't matter, or we're a bunch of monkeys throwing money around. But look just 2 years later, the NASDAQ was 1,100, there were stocks, technology stocks, that were profitable, debt-free, good businesses that were trading less than book value, and
mm-hmm.
some of them were trading. I remember recommending Micromuse when it was like $1.43, and it had $2 cash and $3 book value. How can a stock be trading for less than cash on hand with no debt?
Right.
The market was telling you this company was going out of business. It eventually gets taken out by IBM for $12. So I'm always cautious in looking at what the market's saying. I take it with a grain of salt because the market is wrong as often as it's right in terms of how people read it, what it's forecasting. In terms of fighting the tape, well, if you've been fighting this market the whole way up, you're not listening to what it's saying. It's saying we're going higher until we stop going higher, but that doesn't mean it's saying everything is hunky-dory with the economy. Sometimes the twain don't meet, and
right.
You end up with just because the market's rocking and rolling doesn't mean that the economy will be also.
Right. And my favorite is when you have the economists who are really good at economy and doing that starting to forecast stocks, like Rubini did only a few weeks ago.
Rubini? Listen, my friend Dave Rosenberg, who was dead right heading into the collapse.
He said, call me at 1,000. I was speaking to him about this. Remember when he said that? Call me at 1,000. I'm thinking, no, he didn't say it to me.
1,000 on the Dow or the S&P?
No. He was probably thinking 1,000 on the Dow. But no, on the S&P, he made a comment, not to me directly, but a general comment. Hey, you know what? I don't want to hear about any of this. Call me when it's at 1,000. We'll talk again. And he keeps on fighting it.
This is on the way up or on the way down?
On the way up.
Well, here we are.
Yeah, hello.
And here we are at 10,000. Yeah. I mean, it's you know, this week the Dow broke through 10,000.
Yeah.
And to basically dismiss the rally as it's pricey and it's this and it's that. I've been describing this as the most hated rally in Wall Street history.
Yep.
And I think it is. But you have to, if you're a trader, you have to be nimble and know how to play this. If you're managing other people's money, and that's what we do in the office, in Fusion, we run other people's money, I can give you a million reasons why this market should not go $1 higher.
Yep.
But our clients would have a fit if I said, but intellectually, here's why the market is wrong. They don't want to hear that. They're
right.
Like, you have to we know they want us participating in the upside. Look, we're still running 25% cash. We're still running with some hedges. But that doesn't mean
listen, it's a whole different world. I'm, you know, with the same thing. I mean, you can't just be blatantly in this market. There's too much risk on a week-to-week basis, to be honest with you.
That's exactly right. And we see no signs that this is about to roll over anytime soon. That doesn't mean it can't roll over and die next week.
Right.
But the usual signs that we look at, things like breadth and liquidity and momentum and sentiment, none of these things are at levels that say a high probability of the market correcting significantly anytime soon.
Not to mention the support every single time it goes down 1 point on the S&P.
You know, when we went from, here's a good way to think of it. We went from 14.2 in October 07 to 11.5 before Lehman collapsed. That was your typical 10-month, 20% recession bear market. But from 11.5 to 6,500, that was 5,000 points in 6 months. So normally when you have a sell-off, there's some resistant levels. There are people who bought on the way down. There your overhead resistance. There the supply that... The fall was so fast, it's a giant air pocket, so there is no sellers waiting at every level. There is no sellers at 8,000, 9,000, 10,000. As you get closer to that 11 and change level, I think it becomes much heavier lifting. But over here at you know, between, let's call it 9,500 and 10,500, there's until we see a significant correction and a significant overhead reaction, overhead supply, it's it doesn't take a whole lot of buying to move the market up.
And, Not to mention the fact of the amount of cash that's being pumped in from every direction, from every country.
The liquidity, that's one of the factors we look at. Not necessarily the money market mutual funds.
Abby Joseph Cohn from Goldman talks about that all the time. That's her thing, you know what I mean? It's $4
trillion. She's wrong. If you look at the chart of the S&P and the money market mutual funds, you could see that, you know, there is no inverse correlation. There is no, the market sells off and that goes up, and then that goes down, and that money finds its way into the stock market. That just statistically is not valid. It is one of many things that she has been horribly, horribly wrong
about. But it sounds good. It sounds good.
One of my favorite, you know, I read a lot of old Wall Street books, and I try and keep current with what's out, but I'm a fan of going back, and not just Jesse Livermore, but there's a bunch of people who put out books like Wyckoff, and there's a book that was written by Bennett Goodspeed, I want to say the 60s or 70s. It was called The Tao Jones, T-A-O Jones. Yeah. And he talks about the pundits and talking heads in the media who sound really good but have no clue what they're describing, and he calls them the articulate incompetents. And these are the people who really could sell ice to the Eskimos, but are just clueless sons of bitches when it comes to understanding what moves the market, what drives investor sentiment, what makes things go up and down. And I've always loved that expression, the articulate incompetence. And there's a laundry list of those folks who sound really good. I won't mention the guy's name, but throughout 08 and the beginning of 09, there was an investment strategist of a $1 trillion long-only management fund who pretty much every day came on CNBC and talked about, you know, we like this market, we're buyers on the dips, we think it's built in. We, you know, he sounded great. Sounded great.
Brian Westbury.
And if you listened to him, you would be destroyed financially.
Well, listen, that was what Brian Westbury did as well. I don't know if the same guy you're talking about.
No, it wasn't Brian. Brian doesn't run nice. Brian doesn't run as much as much money or anywhere near it. I don't know if Brian's office runs. I think Brian is a nice guy. He's amiable. He was right about inflation. We've disagreed about the economy repeatedly, and you know, I don't want to say he's not like Don Luskin. If you do the opposite of Don Luskin, it's money in the bank.
Right.
But Westbury, he's been right, he's been wrong. I think he's pretty much too optimistic most of the time. That's his nature. I'm not a glass half full or a glass half empty type of guy.
Realist.
Yeah, just look at the grim, ugly reality and draw your, you know, start painting the picture from there, as opposed to starting with rose-colored glasses and sunshine. And, you know, sometimes bad things happen, and hope for the best but plan for the worst. And I don't think a lot of people on Wall Street approach it that way. Well, I think they are long only, and everything they do reflects that.
Yeah, let me just say one more thing, because you kicked this off, and it's in my mind. Last week, Mario Gabelli, who I respect enormously, he came on, and I think maybe there's something else that's brewing. You know, you talk about the incompetence and the people that come on there just talking about things that don't know what they're talking about. And the media has been quite agreeable to their friends, if you will. And now he comes on and he starts talking about a small stock that he owns in one of his small funds, Hawk Industries or something of that nature. I think it was HWK. They own 15% over Gabelli, which is the max they can have in this particular fund. And he starts really pushing this thing. Great stock. It's going to double. This stock is up like 18% that day.
Right.
After he pushes this. Now that has got.
How big a market cap is this stock?
It's a mini.
It's below, what do you mean mini? Like below 100 million?
It's a tiny little company with like no float.
I'm surprised that CNBC let him do that. That is really, really just egregious. And I never talk about stocks on the air less than $1 billion. I mean, well, actually, that's not true. I was talking about one stock that at the time was 950, and then it was, you know, intraday swings. It was just under $1 billion. But for the most part, I don't like to talk about stuff less than $1 billion for that exact reason.
131 million market cap.
No, that's just, you don't talk about
average volume, $26,000.
No, that's absurd. He should be ashamed of himself. I mean, you just don't do that.
Yeah, I was pretty shocked. I mean, you should see how this ramped up that day. And
did anybody call him on it?
I don't know. I was thinking, I'm looking right here. It was this day. It was 14. It closed at like 16 and a half that day. Volume spiked like crazy that day. Unbelievable, huh? I mean, and that's Mario Gabelli, by the way. This is
stop and think about it. They have billions under management. How, you know, a 15% position in 100 million. It's chump change to the size of his funds. Why on earth would he even talk about it? I didn't see it, so I'm reluctant to comment on it too much, but what you're describing just sounds wholly inappropriate. He should have known better, and CNBC should have said, let's not talk about these micro-cap stocks on the air. It's just wrong.
Yeah.
By the way, you don't know what happened. You don't know. I've actually said and done things with on the air, and sometimes the producer comes up and said, hey, you know, we prefer not to do that.
Right.
I just don't know if Super Mario is chastised the same way I am.
I hear you.
Not that I've been on a CNBC in some time. I seem to have lost my...
That's
not true. I was on Kudlow, too.
You have a much...
I haven't done Squawk Box in forever.
Too high of an intellect.
Persona non grata.
Yeah, your intellect is way over, you know, you use big words.
Every time I watch in the morning, I just want to... we don't have any TVs in our office,
right,
but we threw them out a couple of years ago. But when I get dressed in the morning, I'm watching it, and I'm constantly arguing with Kernan. I love Becky Quick. I think she's great.
Yep.
But Kernan, I'm constantly, dude, how could you say that? Man, it just makes me nuts.
Do you know what they said? You want to hear something?
I haven't guest hosted Darren forever, and I really want to go and set him straight.
Let me tell you something, what they said. When GE's earnings came out last time,
which they shouldn't even talk about,
correct,
but that's a whole other story.
They talk about that, and Becky and Joe were talking about it, and they said, you know what, the earnings came out, the stock really didn't do well. And she said, you know what, I probably didn't, you know, talk about it the right way. Next time you should talk about it. I said, what? What do you
Can
mean?
Can I tell you something? I'm going to say something that I've never said on CNBC, but I'd love the opportunity to. I think Jack Welch is the most overrated CEO in modern history.
Yeah, yeah.
He started his tenure at the beginning of a two-decade bull market. He got out just as the bull market rolled over, and he had a magic box called GE Capital that he pulled a penny out of every time he needed one to magically beat earnings by a cent. And give credit to Jeff Immelt. He was left with a giant mess and really did a nice job. You know, I was not very plugged into Immelt and didn't really know him or his work. I saw him speak at a Wired conference about 4 months ago. Guy was fantastic. I mean, what you want in a CEO.
Mm-hmm.
Smart and a little humble and sincere, and I came away. That's the first time I walked out of any one of these sort of conferences where you say, wow, that CEO really impressed me. There were a couple of people that were less impressive, others that were more impressive, but Immelt's really, you know, just completely straightforward, blunt, honest. You don't expect that from these guys. Most of these guys are snake oil salesmen,
yep,
and I was impressed with him. As much as I've grown to be unimpressed with Welch, who everybody thinks is the greatest CEO of the century, I don't. I mean, he made some good moves, but he did a lot of stuff that was pretty sleazy.
Yep, I hear you. All right, let's wrap it up there again. Barry Ritholtz over at, it used to be The Big Picture. Now it's Ritholtz.
Well, it's still The Big Picture. It's Fusion IQ. The Big Picture is at Ritholtz.com and Fusion-IQ. I'm sorry, fusioniqrank.com. You think I should know this stuff.
I'll put a link on the site because I know you guys also... Didn't you still doing like a free trials? Or no? That's a no.
I don't know. I don't think... Every now and then they'll roll out an advertising well, we're on an advertising thing and do a free trial. But, you know, it's sort of like a mini Bloomberg, like a 1/100th of the size of a Bloomberg terminal. So there is a learning curve. It will take a couple of weeks. By the time you're done learning everything, your trial will be up. So we find people haven't been having a hard time with, you know, paying the $49 a
yep,
month.
I hear it.
If it keeps you out of trouble or identifies some good trades for you, and the testimonials we've gotten from people have been saying exactly that, you know, it's worth that tenfold. And the idea is to give individual investors an institutional-powered quant tool, but for pennies versus what, you know, the various prop desks, hedge funds, they spend tens of millions of dollars developing these things and keep it all in-house.
Yep.
We spent quite a few million dollars developing this and have a growing subscriber base, so we're pleased.
No, it's great. I've used it. I haven't seen it lately. I should probably go check it out again.
Well, we just ran out 3.0, the new version of it, and you'll see it's tighter and cleaner, and a couple of more screens are built into it, and you'll see heat maps and some other interesting things. I'm pleased with the way the development process has been running.
Great. All right, now make sure to get his book, Bailout Nation. I think you'll enjoy that. It's the story of the god-awfulness of what happened over the last few years. And Barry, we'll speak soon. When I get to New York, we'll definitely hook up.
Absolutely. Speak to you soon, Andrew.
Well, thanks to Barry Ritholtz. He's always, isn't he great? Lots of good information to talk about, and I think that very enjoyable overall and informative, and he doesn't hold back, does he? Doesn't hold back. Barry's great about that. So anyway, I wanted to thank him, and I encourage you to go check out Fusion IQ. I'm going to see if we can get a free trial out of him or something. I don't know, maybe. But if not, I still encourage. For $49, what's the big deal? $39, $49. I mean, it's a pretty cool product. It really is. So I encourage you to check that out as well. But I'll put some links on the site to see if there's something else that we can, you know, something else that we could do, and I'll contact Barry. But in the meantime, if you have any questions, you know where to find me. And just to give you a little bit of a forward view of things, what I'm finding right now is that when I look at the markets and I look at the stocks underlying it, really this is a stock picker's market. I think you know that, because we're seeing so much variation on a daily basis. You know, one day we'll see a sector moving up, and the next day it's down. You see something up 8 points, 10 points one day, and 10 points down the next day. You know, one day energy is hot, the next day it's very cold. You have to be kind of very careful right now, not in a bad way, but simply this, that you're going to have volatility. You're going to have to be nimble. We've talked about this for a while, but you know what? You have to be disciplined. You have to be disciplined in that, you know what? You have to have certain stops put in. You have to have additional buy targets put in. So in other words, you find a stock that you like, you did the research, you want to look at maybe buying it at, I'm picking a number, $50, that's the price you're buying it for. Okay, you're in, you bought yourself a 1, 2% position. Where is the next point you're going to buy in again? Are you ever going to buy in as it's moving up? Maybe if it moves to 51.5, there's some very, very clear resistance right there. You clear the resistance, you know what? That's when I'm going to put additional money to work. Move it to a 2% position, 3% position, you know, and whatever the maximum you have is and what the design of your portfolio calls for. And then on top of that, where are you going to take your money out? You're going to use something like a stop, an alert. Are you going to do a trailing stop, or is it going to be a support point that you're going to say, you know, no longer am I going to move past here? Am I going to use stochastics? Am I going to use MACD? What am I going to use to cause me to sell the stock so that I don't hold on to this forever and, you know, take it down 50% in a day or two? Where's the catalyst? What am I using for my information source? How am I tracking things? So just keep that in mind. I think that's very important right now as we go through the earnings season. We'll see how this progresses. We'll talk about this a little bit more next week, what's happening with the earnings season, because, you know, is there a changing environment that's going to be occurring in the market? So far, it's been, you know, all euphoria. We're not out of business as a stock market, not out of business as a country, and that's great. You know, where do we go next? Do we want revenues to really start picking up, or are we just happy with the fact that we have, you know, basically stagnant revenues, and we have at the same time, you know, decent earnings that are based on expense cutting? I mean, that's okay. But how long will investors tolerate that? That's the big question. Until next time, I appreciate you listening. I thank you for listening. Go check out thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Of course, follow me on Twitter. You know, we're upwards of 4,000 or so. Come on, let's bring it up to 5,000. A lot of people out there, go out there right now. Go to twitter.com/AndrewHorowitz, one word, and sign up. You'll get podcasts before anybody else, unless they're on Twitter too, because it automatically will alert you on Twitter when the podcast is posted. Isn't that good? You'll get it probably before iTunes does.
subscribe on iTunes, tell a friend, and most of all, do me a favor. If you like what you hear, just take 1 second, go over to iTunes and put a review on there. Tell us if you like it, you don't like it, whatever it is. We'll see you next time. Thanks for joining me on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.